Lecture 4, Etruscan Cities of the Dead.
Now, I have to say that I enjoy strolling through cemeteries, thinking about the lives the dead once lived and reading the inscriptions on their headstones, reading about how those lives are summarized on the markers, and reflecting on what decisions went into their burial locations. So, I'm biased, openly, honestly biased. That being said, the Etruscan cemeteries I've been fortunate enough to visit have been the highlight of these experiences for me. They are awesome and wonderful. Actually, we don't refer to the burial grounds of the Etruscans as cemeteries. Each is called a necropolis, that is literally a city of the dead. And necropolis is a far more accurate term because each necropolis is truly organized as a city. That is, if cities consisted only of residences. It's like the opposite of Epcot Center, where cities consist only of restaurants and shops. In the Etruscan tradition, a necropolis laid out a city carved of houses, truly houses for eternity, of solid rock. Etruscan cities of the dead tell us surprising amounts about their world. They provide evidence of the development of urban planning, arrangements of domestic architecture, shifting social relations, and the stresses on the society from near constant warfare. They also illuminate much about Etruscan burial practices, and even something about their beliefs on death and the afterlife. But we can reach some preliminary conclusions even prior to looking inside. First, the idea of eternal life or life after death is implicit in the very idea of houses of the dead. Note also that the use of houses as an organizing principle for a cemetery reveals the family as the major organizing and identity group in the Etruscan community. Now, this might seem natural to us today, but there's no law of nature to institutionalize the custom of burying the extended family together in multi-generational tombs. In many cultures, the more common burial group is the immediate family, with some special cemeteries set aside to honor individuals distinguished by their service to the community. But there's no evidence that the Etruscans ever did anything similar. That is a significant cultural marker that sets them apart from their ancient neighbors. The ancient Greeks and Romans often buried people grouped by immediate family. They also created special cemeteries for individuals whom they wanted to recognize for their contributions. But in the Etruscan tradition, the extended family was buried together in a tomb resembling and taking the place of the family home. The family that lives together, stays together forever. Now, one of the best sites at which to study Etruscan tombs and the development of residential architecture and city planning is the Bondetaccia Necropolis at the Etruscan city of Carre, modern Cerveteri. It's the largest surviving necropolis from the ancient Mediterranean, and it contained thousands of tombs organized along roads with gutters, drains, and sidewalks, all elements cut out of solid rock and representative of Etruscan urban planning. We can still walk down these streets and gain a sense of the space, scale, and infrastructure of an Etruscan city. The tombs in the Bondetaccia Necropolis date from the 8th to the 3rd centuries BC, with the earliest examples being large, circular, grass-covered mounds, a type of tomb referred to as a tumulus. Often, each of these grassy mounds will consist of 3 or 4 tombs carved out of the volcanic bedrock. Clearly, the foundation of the cemetery predates the use of orthogonal planning, that is, laying out cities in rectangular blocks that we see developed in the 5th century BC. 2 design features found repeatedly in the tombs replicate contemporary Etruscan and later Roman building practice in houses and temples alike. The first feature is that the tombs slash houses were organized symmetrically, with the entrance at the short end of a long axis, and interior rooms clustered at the far end. The second feature is a tendency towards tripartite organization, with rooms often appearing in groups of three, as in the Tomb of the Greek Vases, about 525 BC, at the Bondytachian Acropolis. Wall niches to hold bodies are also found in threes, as in the Tomb of the Reliefs, about 300 BC in the same necropolis. These two separate design features are found together in the Tomb of the Shields and Chairs, about 500 BC, also at Cerveteri. Now, the Tomb of the Shields and Chairs seems to reflect Etruscan domestic architecture. Although carved out of solid rock, it has elements of wood construction, ceiling beams, door frames, and moldings. The layout includes features adopted in later Roman houses, including the central hallway leading into a single common room, which will become the atrium in the Roman house. Opposite the entrance of the tomb is a three-room suite, with a wider central room flanked by two smaller side rooms, features that reflect tripartite temples as well as the Roman tablinum. Now, the 8th and 7th century BC tombs at the Bondytachian Acropolis are carved with a consistent organization of a central passage leading to and flanked by a series of generally symmetrically arranged chambers, which appear to imitate the size, shape, and organization of rooms in Etruscan houses. Many of the passages show signs of how zealously these early stone carvers preserved architectural features of the time. Early tomb passages are roofed with corbelled arches. This form of early non-true arch is created with block construction, that is, by stacking wall blocks up to perhaps shoulder height. Above that, each successive level steps inward until finally a pair of blocks, often up to six courses up, meets to seal the opening at its apex. Sometimes the inner overhanging edges are carved off, giving the passage a trapezoidal shape and profile. Although there's no practical reason to do so, the passages of many early tombs at Cerveteri preserve this form as though they were built out of blocks, not carved from solid stone. In early examples at Cerveteri, such as the Tomb of the Painted Lions, which dates to about 650 BC, two chambers flank the long passage, and a third is carved at the end opposite the arched doorway leading into the tumulus or mound. It's possible that each chamber represents a house. If so, this could be a tomb for three presumably related families who could be branches of an extended family. Interestingly, although carved out of solid rock, tombs such as that of the Painted Lions replicate residential building practices instituted only slightly earlier, such as the single-room oval houses constructed of timber, mud, and thatch that emerged in the 8th century BC. The roofing systems display a surprisingly sophisticated architectural tradition. The oval or round rooms of the early tombs replicate in stone the fan-shaped rafters of what we conclude were actual roofing systems. The rafters radiate out from a central hub like the ribs of an umbrella. Many of the tombs are carved to resemble the timber framing and other perishable materials used to construct the houses of living Etruscans at the time. For instance, the roofing above the rafters in some tombs appears to be actual thatching. Now, in other slightly later tombs from about 650 to 600 BC, we find that in some cases that the tomb carvers have, just above the rafters, chiseled the edges of overlapping terracotta roof tiles, which would have been visible from inside the house. These features provide critical evidence of the shift from organic to more permanent. permanent materials in Etruscan home construction, a shift we wouldn't know about if it weren't for this form of architectural sclerosis, this hardening of the architecture. The interior decoration is simple in the early tombs, perhaps also reflecting actual practice in homes. Pairs of beds are carved in each chamber, and carved stone versions of woven baskets are found in some as well. Tombs from the period of 600 to 550 BC demonstrate the shift to completely rectilinear architecture, which we think replicates actual cut stone block construction, a major development over wattle and daub, that is, the woven sticks and mud construction of earlier practice, and a major improvement in the category of a house that won't dissolve in a heavy thunderstorm. Most of the tombs from this period have elements that were necessary in a real house, including a central ridge beam that runs along the length of the roof, and timber joists attached to it, all supported by columns and pillars. An excellent example is the Tomb of the Capitals, dated to about 575 BC, named for an architectural feature, the elaborate capitals that top the columns carved in its antechamber. Now, superficially, it resembles earlier tombs, with a passageway, a pair of side chambers, and multiple burial chambers at the end. But we can see clear architectural developments in the Tomb of the Capitals. The passageway, rather than an oval shape, terminates in a rectangular antechamber, which leads to three rectangular burial chambers beyond. The doors are framed with faux timber framing carved from the living rock. The Tomb of the Capitals antechamber is decorated with eight carved beds running along the walls, except where there are open doorways. And most significantly, two carved columns support the faux wood roof beams and rafters overhead. The architectural details from which the tomb takes its name are Aeolic, an early Greek order. You might never have heard of this style. Not as well known as the Greek Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian capitals, Aeolic is actually older and may be the style out of which Ionic developed. Its appearance here at Cerveteri is particularly notable because the form was first found in Asia, specifically Asia Minor, that is modern Turkey, where it developed from the earlier forms of Near Eastern architecture. The columns in the tomb are carved with facets rather than flutes. By comparison, Greek Ionic and Corinthian columns commonly are fluted. The capitals, from which the tomb takes its name, feature a pair of volutes or spiraling scrolls. Now, later authors attribute the volute pattern to the design of a ram's horn or of a particular species of a plant. I compare it to fiddlehead ferns myself. But its similarity to any of these doesn't mean that it was based on one of them. It can be traced to its earliest recognizable form in Asia Minor, and it spread from there to the Phoenician homeland of coastal modern-day Lebanon, and finally to Sicily. Essentially, the Aeolic style follows the spread of colonization, that is, Phoenician colonization, from the eastern Mediterranean to the west. The appearance of the Aeolic style here from about 600 BC is great evidence that the Etruscans are culturally connected to the major civilizations of the eastern Mediterranean. And although it's impossible to say if they adopted the style from the Greeks or the Phoenicians, that connectivity in itself demonstrates just how intertwined these people were in and around Italy. Now, from the Tomb of the Capitals antechamber, which operates as a sort of atrium, the three burial chambers open across from the entryway. Each is a rectangular room, each one outfitted with a pair of beds, running along the left and right walls, respectively. The central room is slightly larger than the two flanking ones, and extends that Etruscan organization of internal space as seen in excavations at the town of Merlo, about 25 kilometers south of Siena, and in earlier temples with tripartite cellas or central interior spaces. Paired beds in these burial chambers belong to, we conclude, married couples. This means that Etruscan women occupy as much space and with as much visibility as do the men. That's not a pattern found in other Mediterranean civilizations. We think it means that in death, as in life, Etruscan women held positions of something close to equality to men. Or it means that families are equally reflective of male and female lines. Either way, these are not ideas found elsewhere in the ancient world. Now, another tomb at Cerveteri is important not only for its form, but for its furniture. The Tomb of the Shields and Chairs, which dates from about 520 to 500 BC, was carved in the same tumulus as the century earlier Tomb of Painted Lions, which I mentioned a few moments ago. In form, the tomb is almost identical to the Tomb of the Capitals. It consists of a short passageway flanked by lateral chambers, which opens into an atrium whose walls are lined with carved beds. Three burial chambers are carved into the wall opposite the entrance, each of which again contains a pair of stone beds. Faux wooden doorways mark entry into these inner chambers, whose ceilings are outlined with carved beams. The furniture in the atrium, however, is the most remarkable component of this tomb. It consists, in addition to the beds, of two large chairs with footstools carved from the bedrock. Above each chair, hanging on the wall, is a shield. The chairs are rounded forms with circular backs and arms above the flat seats. They greatly resemble forms seen today in wicker or rattan. They may, in fact, be based on forms of more perishable materials, like the architecture that surrounds them. But their closest counterparts in the ancient world are the chairs of Roman priests and magistrates. These operated as very visible symbols of office and rank. We have only a few of them preserved, the best being the chair of the Bishop of Ravenna, Maximian. Now, the shields and chairs in this family tomb/house are reflective of the men's place in the community rather than their familial identities. For instance, such symbols identify the men not by their relationships to other members of the family as fathers, brothers, or sons, but rather by their public roles. Specifically, carved chairs and shields reflect the two outlets for elite male competition, or phrased more positively, male social contribution. Warfare, as symbolized by the shields, and government service, as symbolized by the chairs conferred upon community magistrates. The appearance of these symbols with increasing frequency during the course of the 6th century BC reflects the political changes of that period. It was a time when many peoples around the Mediterranean, including the Etruscans, Romans, and the Athenians, were establishing democratic or republican forms of government in place of the kings and tyrants who had ruled them earlier. This rejection of kingship is seen elsewhere in the Etruscan world, and the assertion of public roles for adult males was a side effect of that. 5th century BC cities in the Etruscan world appear to have seen rapid social and economic shifts that mirrored the political. As the kings and hereditary aristocracies lost power, they were replaced by a rising class of what we might call middle-class citizens. More aptly, these citizens, soldier, merchants became the new leaders and economic engines of their community. They took positions as elected public officials and priests. Essentially, the social pyramid that had a small group at the very top who ruled and held the majority of the wealth flattened out into, if not a pancake, at least a shorter pyramid. Wealth seems to have spread more widely, probably because of trade and the vast commercial links between the Etruscans and all of the peoples of the central Mediterranean. This shift in social structure is seen in the new urban planning of cities with the adoption of orthogonal planning. The necropolis of the Etruscan world mirror it as well. One of the best places to see this is at the Etruscan city of Orvieto. Just outside the walled hilltop, there's the necropolis that we know of today as the Crocifisso del Tufo. It has a series of orthogonally aligned streets and blocks with rows of small rectangular single or double chamber tombs built adjacent to one another. It's as though the necropolis preserves a new section of the city, composed of townhouses laid out in blocks rather than freestanding atrium-style houses. And above the doorway of each of the 130 tomb houses here is the name of the original occupant, or more probably, the name of the head of the household that occupied that tomb. Of these 130, 124 are names of men, and 6 record women as heads of household. So the equality of women in Etruria might be overstated. At the Bondetacea necropolis outside Cerveteri, which I walked you through earlier, the old tumulus tombs abut newer square tombs constructed in the 4th century BC. These are made out of blocks of cut stone rather than being carved from bedrock. Laid out along streets and blocks that demonstrate orthogonal planning, these newer, identical, stone-cut tombs reveal the dramatic changes that came over Etruscan society during the 5th century BC by reflecting the inroads of democratization and the decline of aristocratic society. The Tomb of the Reliefs in Bondetacea, constructed for an extended family in the 3rd century BC, is by far my favorite, and it's one of the most revealing of the Etruscan world. Rather than a complex of separate houses for various branches of the family, this tomb consists of a single chamber. It was carved with a roof beam and joists, and is supported by 2 large square pillars. These are topped with aeolic capitals, demonstrating their use in Etruria long after they'd gone out of fashion in Greek architecture and been replaced by the Ionic. The walls of the tomb are not broken by doorways, but by carved bed-like niches where bodies were laid, separated by shallow pilasters, that is, shallow vertical pillars engaged to the walls. These themselves are finished with aeolic capitals. Bedding and very realistic pillows are also carved from the bedrock. The tripartite division of earlier chambers was by now retained only in vestigial form. The back wall of the chamber, thought to be the most prestigious location in the tomb, was carved with 3 burial niches. The central one is distinguished by figural carving on the wall beneath it. A raised ledge of about 20 inches high runs around the walls on all sides, deep enough to hold 32 additional bodies, were they to be laid out shoulder to shoulder with their heads facing the wall and feet towards the center of the room. Relief carving, which after all gives the tomb its name, the Tomb of the Reliefs, covers virtually every surface and is why the tomb is such a critical source for information on Etruscan daily life. Much of the raised relief work in stucco preserves its original color and so gives us our best sense of how tombs and houses might have originally looked. It reproduces tools and household objects all seemingly hanging on the wall ready for use, Among these, we can still recognize a coil of rope, a machete, a stout stick hanging from a hook by a leather thong, an axe, a pitcher made of terracotta, judging by its color, chisels, a Greek drinking cup of the type called a kylix, a chest, some jewelry, a fan, even a cat in relief about to spring on a domestic fowl, perhaps a duck or a goose. My money is on the goose. There's also a wooden chest on the floor as though it were pushed up against the wall. Strongbox might be a more accurate description than chest, based on its lock and the metal studs covering it. A relief frieze runs around the room above the wall niches. This frieze illustrates armor and weapons. Swords, shields, helmets, and greaves are found across the chamber. These represent one of the key male identities, warrior. Curiously, the other identity, citizen or civic official, is not found. There are no chairs to go with the armor and weapons. This seeming imbalance has been the source of a great deal of scholarly discussion. The emphasis on weapons might reflect the incessant and repeated warfare that took place between the Etruscans and Rome during the late 4th and early 3rd centuries BC. In fact, more than a century of almost continuous warfare ran from the Roman siege of Veii in 396 BC through the Samnite and Etruscan wars of 340 to 290 BC and the capitulation of Capua in 338 BC, to the Roman occupation of southern Etruria, followed by the establishment of the colony at Cosa in 273 BC. These were all wars that the Etruscans lost. Service and warfare might have been the defining characteristic of Etruscan men at this phase in their civilization. All of this detailed stone carving in the Tomb of the Reliefs required a very large number of very skilled workers. They couldn't have moved from community to community as we know wall painters did. There was too much work, which by its nature, of course, was not portable. So we conclude that each Etruscan city had its own workforce of skilled carvers to create the tombs in its necropolis. Regional variations on tomb carving support this conclusion. Now, I'm making this clear because the existence of these carvers might solve what has been a problem in Italian archaeology since the 1930s. But first, we need a little bit more background. Let me remind you of the bitter rivalry between the Greek city of Cumae, the earliest and northernmost Greek colony, and the neighboring Etruscan city of Capua. Both founded in the 8th century BC during the struggle to control the resources of Campania in southern Italy. This competition led to a series of battles and skirmishes across a number of centuries. One of the largest and most important of these was the naval Battle of Cumae in 474 BC. More than any other conflict between Cumae and Capua, this was something of a regional clash. Think Napoleonic Wars in 19th century Europe. Cumae was supported by other Greek cities, including Syracuse, at the time the largest, richest, and most powerful of the Greek city-states in the Western Mediterranean, which sent its fleet north to Cumae. The Etruscans gathered their navy from many of their own communities, probably drawing on all of the coastal cities. The result was a large-scale naval battle and a serious defeat for the Etruscans. This was their Waterloo. The loss weakened the Etruscans' ability to project their power into southern Italy and led to the gradual loss of all of their lands and cities south of the Tiber River. It's commemorated in Pindar's first Pythian ode as, quote, freeing Greece from slavery, unquote, which is hyperbole. It's also documented by an Etruscan helmet dedicated by the tyrant of Syracuse, Heron, to the sanctuary of Zeus at Olympia. Now, let's fast forward to 1932. Amadeo Maiori, the great Italian archaeologist who was responsible for excavating much of Pompeii and the imperial villas on the island of Capri, was then excavating the site of Cumae. He made a remarkable discovery, which he concluded could only be the Grotto of the Sibyl. Now, the Sibyl was the oracle of Apollo at Cumae, one of the two most important oracles in the Greek world. Like the other at Delphi, she occupied a venerated religious sanctuary of Apollo. She was responsible for dispensing advice that changed the direction of ancient history, especially the history of Rome. Now, the grotto is a long tunnel cut through the solid rock of the Acropolis. Its main features include a passageway more than 430 feet long, which runs into the hill of the Acropolis. It opens along one side on the flank of the hill to provide air and light through a series of large windows. The other side opens into a series of inner chambers, including one at the very end, which Amadeo Maiori concluded was where the Sibyl received visitors who presented her with questions and where she, under the influence of the god Apollo, gave answers. At this point, you might reasonably wonder what all this has to do with the Etruscans, or tombs, or the Battle of Cumae. The connection is in the very odd and recognizable shape of the passage. In profile, it's a trapezoid. It consists of carved walls that come up to about shoulder height and then taper in as if they're a series of corbelled courses or layers of stone. This shape is not found in Greek architecture, not even in the Greek tunnels and mines found in the region. It does, however, almost exactly match the profile of the tomb passages in the Bondetaccia Cemetery at Cerveteri. The late Canadian scholar Alexander McKay argued that the entire passage and chamber complex was carved by Etruscan prisoners of war taken in the Battle of Cumae in 474 BC. Now, while there's no literary evidence to support this conclusion, the use of such prisoners to quarry or mine for their captors is well supported in ancient Italy. Despite the lack of corroborating evidence, there's nothing to argue against it, nor were there any good Greek precedents for this work. It's intriguing to think that one of the most significant Greek religious spaces and the site of their greatest oracle in the Western Mediterranean might owe its form to Etruscan prisoners of war.